So anybody who has spent any time with me in person, in conversation, they know that I am one of the loudest blabbermouths you could ever imagine. I mean, I don't shut up. And when I talk to people, I sometimes seem to get into a realm of storytelling where somebody just has to sit quietly and wait for me to finish before they get any chance to get any words in. So the question that remains then is, how was I able to do 400 plus interviews across five documentaries? My name is Jason Scott, and this is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, brought to you by Jeff Atwood, Daniel Boyd, and hundreds of other patrons who are helping me get out of a mountain of debt. Hey, so I'm recording this episode in one of the rooms at the Internet Archive in San Francisco, where I work. I'm here for the week to MC the once-a-year celebration of the Internet Archive. So, while the sound of the room is a little bit different, I'll try to keep the show exactly the same. And what I'm talking about this time is interviewing. I've done hundreds of interviews over the last 15 years for all of my documentaries, and this is not a skill that I had throughout my teens and my 20s. What happened is that the BBS documentary was going to be one of the largest projects I ever took on. Here I was going to go from simply collecting bulletin board system era artifacts to creating some sort of multi-hour mini-series about the dial-up bulletin board system. And to do that, I was going to need to interview people, hundreds of them, to really get the story. And I was absolutely terrified that I would just not have the skills to pull this off. So here's what I would do. I would strike up conversations with people for about a year before the documentary began production, and I would ask a person a question, or I would start a conversation with them, but then I would start to pull back, which was much harder than I thought it would be. And I would say something that would get the conversation going and look at them and start to build up the face. Turns out to me, the face is the most important part of the interviewing. If you don't have a face that encourages people to want to tell you more, a kind of nodding, knowing, enlightened face that says, "I want to hear even more about this," people will get a weird vibe and they'll shut up. They won't go deeper. So I built up that face and I learned to listen to what others say in a way that would pull out the next question. I've never been a fan of having a rote set of questions, pre-made, that you just shove somebody into. You ask them something, and then regardless of what they say, you ask the next thing until you have your 10 questions answered. I hate that. You lose so much opportunity. You know, if you actually listen to people and you listen to the words that they're saying, they drop so many hints about where they want things to go. So that was absolutely something I learned during those initial party-based conversations. So when I finally got my film equipment, I needed to interview somebody that I would be comfortable with, who, if everything went wrong, I could go back to later with no hard feelings. And the person that ended up being was Count Zero of Cult of the Dead Cow, who had been a friend for years at that point. And we went to his apartment, and he had a beautiful apartment full of gothic things, and we set up all these lights and set up all of these interesting soundscapes to make it sound as perfect as it could. And then I interviewed him for something like 3 hours. And when I listen to that tape, I am a mess. I just don't know what I'm doing. I'm asking him things and kind of meandering, and I still can't help telling a few stories of my own, and he's nodding, and so I have lots of footage of somebody nodding. But somehow, Count Zero and I were able to put together some really wonderful clips. At one point, I asked him about his friends that he had met, and he realized that pretty much every major friend he still had was somebody he had met on a bulletin board system. So bulletin boards had brought him his friends. So we really did get a little bit of gold in that first interview. From there, it was just a matter of lining up interviews around the country, and asking people to be ready for me to show up. and getting scheduled time with them such that I could put one or two or three interviews in the same geographic area and just build footage. Now, what I would have liked with the bulletin board system documentary is to have done dozens of interviews before I got to a really critical one. You know, someone who was a vital part of the bulletin board system story. But as luck would have it, within the third week, I had to go interview Ward Christensen, the co-creator of the BBS and the creator of X-Modem. It was just pure terror for me. I flew to Chicago and I met up with a group who ran something called the Chicago Area Computer Hobbyist Exchange, or CASH. CASH had been the user group that Ward Christensen was going to in the late 1970s when he came up with the idea of making something like a bulletin board that was in a hallway for that user group. So it was nice to interview these guys. They had remembered the bulletin board system from the early era and what drove them, and they gave great interviews, just really fantastic ones. Then I went and interviewed Ward, and I did it at a hotel room that I had, and we had the original BBS, the original hardware of the first BBS, and we put it next to him, and I interviewed him with a couple people in the room, just in case they had to shout out ideas. I did 3 hours on the first day, 2 hours on the second day, 5 hours, and by the end, we had run out of things to talk about, I guarantee you. If there is an answer to be given by Ward Christensen on any kind of subject related to the bulletin board system, it's probably on those tapes. Ward was amazing. He was such a friendly, outgoing guy. He was humble. He absolutely stressed that if I ever found somebody historically who had done what he had done before he had done it, please give those people the glory. He was just not in it for the name and the celebrity. He was just a real inspiration for a historical figure to meet. I ended up interviewing Randy Seuss, who also co-created the BBS, but that went a little bit differently. I'll talk about it in a moment. Traveling for the BBS documentary was murder. It was something where I would land in Chicago, drive to Wisconsin, interview somebody, drive over to Michigan, interview somebody else, then drive down to Indiana. I mean, it was like that. It was like a 100-mile trip between interviews sometimes. I'd be interviewing people at 9 in the morning and then interviewing other people 9 at night. I quickly discovered my limits. Turns out, at the time, in my 30s, I was capable of doing about 330 miles of driving in a single day before I started to see weird illusions on the highway and start to use the rumble strip as a snooze alarm. There was one time in Texas that I interviewed some people, went back to the hotel room late, slept for 3 hours, went out, interviewed a bunch of people, came back, slept for 2 hours, went out again, interviewed a bunch of people, slept for 1 hour, and then got on a plane. I don't think I ever walked right after that. This is the kind of stuff you can do in your youth, and I'm really glad that I chose to do it when I was in my 30s. Now in my 40s, I couldn't dream to do interviews at the breakneck pace that I did with the BBS documentary. All told, there were over 205 interviews done for the documentary, which worked out to about 250 hours of footage. When all was said and done, I had interviewed in 30 states, and I had driven so many thousands of miles I've completely lost track as to where they were. A bunch of interviews really stand out, but I'll tell you about a few. You know, I really made it a point with the BBS documentary to interview just folks. I don't like documentaries where we interview several major figures, then we interview two or three experts, and then it all just gets slammed together. I mean, I'm fascinated to talk to the people who invented Z-modem and X-modem, but I also want to know the people who used Z-modem and X-modem and why they made it part of their lives. So this meant a lot of times of walking into a house and interviewing somebody who had never been interviewed before. And I mean, they were in their 40s or 50s, and nobody had ever traveled to them, set up equipment, and interviewed them on camera about their lives. What I quickly learned was what I called the soliloquy, the sermon. This meant that when a person said that they wanted to be interviewed by me, they kind of had in their mind a bunch of things they wanted to get out. And so you'd set up the equipment and you'd tell them what you wanted, and then they would talk. And it would be a 20-minute sermon about their lives with all the little aspects of BBSs kind of wrapped in there and splattered around. And it was something that they had to get out, and I was there to get it. And then, when they were totally spent, I would then begin to ask questions about what I just heard and the things that were there. This is where, like, amazing jewels came out. People talking about, you know, divorces and moments of triumph or moments of sadness. And it was often an amazing privilege just to be in the room while these stories were being told. An interview that stands out is John Hedke. I interviewed him at his house, and I've described it like bumping into your best friend that you never knew you had. Like, John and I had kind of similar lives and kind of similar outlooks, and we really got along. And so in his interview, there's just so much laughing and so much joy coming from both of us. I also remember that he had a cat that was, I mean, cats like catnip, but he had a thing where he was sprinkling major amounts of catnip in a box, and this cat just kept flipping inside of the box. It was something to see a true addict, a true junkie of catnip. A lot of John's laughing is in the interview, and I suspect a little bit of the cat too. Another person who was a real saint was Dale Coyner. Dale had a whole thing involving motorcycles. He had written motorcycle books, and he had a motorcycle enthusiast's BBS. And he was something that I tried to avoid, which was a fourth interview of the day. Besides my 330-mile limit, I quickly learned about having four interviews in the same day. Three was smart, four was not, and he was a fourth interview. I had been up for so long, and I had driven for so long, that after I set up the equipment, started the camera rolling, and he started to talk, I fell asleep. I mean, I fell asleep. I fell asleep, and I was snoring. And he kept answering the question. God bless Dale. He kept answering the question. In the distance, you can hear snoring, and he talks as if I'm right there. Through some miracle of consciousness, I would wake up after he answered and then ask the next question, and then I would fall asleep again. So Dale and I had this ridiculous, literally sleep interview that ended up with some footage that actually ended up in the documentary, but I had to mix the soundtrack really carefully to hide the snoring. And of course, Randy Seuss, the other half of the BBS, the one who created the hardware that Ward Christensen wrote the software for. A weird little technical thing, I'm just going to mention this just because we're here. The way that the first BBS worked, they didn't really have an auto answer for the BBS in software. It just didn't exist. What they had wired up was this circuit that I thought was really brilliant. When the phone rang and it got to the third ring, it would pick up the phone and reset the BBS. In other words, it would reboot the machine. And in that second or two for it to do all the work, because machines were much simpler then, it would come back up again and automatically connect to the modem. So in that way, it was auto answer before auto answer. Anyway, Randy had no interest in being interviewed. Zero. None. Wanted nothing to do with it. Was not really fond of those days. Thought that that was nostalgic. Didn't want a piece of it. My reaching out to him had not really been that successful. But I was lucky. I had a Sherpa. Peter Zelichenko was and is a Chicago area expert in politics, a great writer whose father had done lots of stuff with computers and bulletin boards, and who himself really wanted the story of the BBS to be told because it's a Chicago story. And there's not many of those stories in common tech history where Chicago is out front. So he really wanted me to get Randy. What he told me was, let's meet at this bar, which is right near Randy, and I'll call him and make the arrangement. So I remember this. I remember us hanging out in this bar, just talking and kibitzing about what parts of the BBS story are important and so on. And then he carefully called Randy's number, which he had, and said to Randy, "Hey, Randy, I'm in the area. I thought I would stop by. I got a guy here, too. He's kind of like doing stuff about BBSs and stuff, and maybe just come by and chat with you. Would that be okay?" And then he said the magic words, "I'll bring some pizza." Turns out that pizza is the key to unlock Randy's heart at the time, and so Randy said yes. So I loaded up my equipment and walked with Peter over to Randy's apartment building, and Randy let us in. He opened the door, gave me a little glance, let us both in, asked if we had the pizza. We had the pizza. So we had a nice pizza dinner and talked a little bit, and at some point Peter just said, "Hey, Randy, is it okay if Jason asks you a few questions?" Randy said yes. So in the BBS documentary, if you ever go see it, the documentary has Randy Seuss and Ward Christensen answering each other's sentences. They're interwoven as if they're having a conversation. This was not the case. Randy and Ward had had a falling out years and years and years before, and so they hadn't talked in a long time. But they had created this thing together, and the thoughts they had about it were very similar, so it wasn't that hard to put them together in editing. And I really can't thank Peter enough for giving me that footage and that time with Randy. And I can't thank Randy enough for overcoming his reluctance to being interviewed. The BBS documentary was so much better for it. So, in the interviews that I do, there's a lot of stuff about technical subjects. You can ask somebody how many times they called a certain BBS, or how they would boot up a machine, or how much it cost them to buy this item or that item, but to be honest, that's not really where my documentaries have ever gone. The moment that you want is where you ask somebody a question and you sense that you've struck somewhere they haven't touched in a long time. A lost love, an amazing triumph, a deep and personal memory that never came up before. When those happen, that I think is the difference between a basic news story and a true documentary. I do want to stress that I never wanted my subjects to regret being interviewed by me. So if somebody was uncomfortable with a subject, I quickly changed it. And if after the interview somebody told me, "You know, I talked about this one thing and I'm not comfortable with it being in the movie," I just took it out. For example, there was a person who talked about a mailing list they were on for women who were in isolated farmhouses where they shared stories to stop each other from going crazy from isolation. And afterwards, she asked me not to put any of it in. So, officially, those lists don't exist. But I'm glad they do. Other times, I have had interviews where a person would answer questions and you could see the tears welling up as they realized what had come before them and what had helped make them what they were. Sometimes I used that footage, sometimes I didn't. In one case, I was interviewing Tom Henderson, and we were talking about his part in the Ark Zip battle of the late 1980s, and at one point he just broke down and started crying. He was talking about getting mail in his mailbox, his P.O. box, and how that was the most important thing. He didn't make much money selling his product, but what mattered to him were these postcards that people would send thanking him for the product. And then this hate mail campaign came to him, and he couldn't bear to go to his P.O. box to get what people had to say, because it was all going to be hateful. And he just started crying. I didn't ask anything. I didn't respond. I just sat there while he cried and then worked himself back up to being able to answer questions again. It was the toughest 2 or 3 minutes of the entire documentary. And also, I remember the time I was kicked out of a house. This actually happened. I went to interview one of the subjects about his hacking days, and he'd actually gone to jail for the hacking days. And I was interviewing him in his house, talking about those days, And he's going on some really interesting rants. He's talking about, freedom and trying to express yourself and so on. And suddenly, behind me, I hear, "What's going on here?" And it's his wife, and she is having none of this. She is very displeased that he is talking about his prison sentence. And, as she points out, in the same town that he was arrested in, with the same police chief who had put him in jail. And the two of them start having, let's call it a domestic dispute, and I'm in the middle of it. She is referring to me, but more like a pest, more like he opened up the door and a deer walked in, and how could you do that? So it was really along the lines of, you're going to let this person talk about this dark part of your life when we're trying to build a new one? And he's telling her about freedom and telling the story. Anyway, I ended up just handing him the tapes. I mean, he'd signed a release, but I said, look, you have to live with your wife for the rest of your life. I'm just here for the night. Take the tapes. If you're comfortable having me use them, send them to me. But otherwise, I get it. And I was out of that house in a couple minutes. And I'll tell you, I was driving away, and I was trying to figure out what I had done wrong or how I could have done it better. And there's just nothing. He just shouldn't have said that he would do the interview without talking to his wife. Speaking of that, I did have one interview that went really south where I had driven 130 miles through the night until it was 4 in the morning to the condo where this next interviewee was going to be in the morning at 9 a.m. And I was weighing ideas, and I finally said, you know what? I'm just going to sleep in a car in a nearby parking lot. So I parked in another parking lot and went to sleep. Now, I don't know if you've done this, and I hope you haven't, but if you sleep overnight in a car, chances are your breath is going to just make the car unbearably hot, even if it's cold outside, so that you have a choice of either being covered in heat and then feeling terrible, or opening the window at various points and freezing to death because you're covered in heat. So I did this, and I was not happy. And it got to be about 8:45, and I phoned him up with the number that I had, and he said to me, "Hey, so I talked to my wife, and she's not comfortable with having somebody in the house for an interview. So can we do this at the McDonald's down the street?" And I was a little angry. So I said, sure. And then I started the car and I drove to another state. So I'm just telling you, if you ever do agree to do an interview, please let all your roommates or your spouse know what you're up to, because it doesn't help people like me to wake up in your parking lot and find out we shouldn't have driven for 130 miles last night. And then there was that one interview that I did during GitLamp. And to explain what happened, you need to understand that I was using something called an HVX200. This is a Panasonic camera that shot high definition onto customized cards. Very expensive camera. But it was a way for me to shoot in high definition at a time that high definition wasn't easily available. And this interviewee was one of two interviews in Florida that I did that were the first two interviews. The first one was Mike Berlin of Infocom fame, and the second one was this teacher. So I interviewed Mike, and it went really well. And then I interviewed this teacher. So I got back to the hotel that night, and I'm going over all the footage, and I realized that the teacher's recording has no sound. Zero sound. His voice is not on there. And I cried. I was, what, 36, 37? And I am hunched over a bathroom sink in a grotty hotel in Florida. And I am crying because I felt like such a failure, such a fake, because I had wasted this guy's time. I had lost the story. I didn't have time to go back. I had just screwed up a fundamental thing after 205 interviews previous. The fact is, these things happen. I try to explain this to people who do documentaries, you do other work. Sometimes you just don't press the button. Sometimes you don't connect the mic. Sometimes you don't put the light in the right place. Sometimes you just don't have the tape. It just happens. And the key is to do as much interviewing as possible so that these inevitable problems don't eat you alive. It's a lesson I carry with me to this day. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and me. Thanks to James Bakoyanu, Sam Johnston, Astrid Smith, and Kevin Waters for donating at the $50 and above reward, and all the hundreds of people who have come together to help me get out of this debt and talk my way out of it. Talk to you next week.